for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Every day for a year, biologist David Haskell returned to the same one-square-meter spot in the Tennessee forest. What he saw there gave him a new understanding of the intricate link between all living things. In a new book titled The Forest Unseen, Haskell gives us an intimate look at the inner workings of the forest. He explains how plants and animals survive the cold, why moss helps clean the water supply, and what causes sibling rivalry among bees. David Haskell joins me in the studio. We'll welcome your questions, comments. Join us by phone at 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to you, sir. It's good to have you here.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. I know that you were thinking about doing this book for quite a while. How did you finally decide what you were going to concentrate and how you were going to structure it?
I have wanted to write a book telling the stories and celebrating the stories of the creatures of the forests of North America for many years, but I hadn't quite figured out the right way to do that. And it came to me that the best way to do that would be to draw together several strands from my own life, to use those in that storytelling enterprises. So I have a meditation practice, a daily practice of meditation, sitting down and just being quiet twice a day. And of course, I'm a teacher of biology and a scientist. So I thought, what would happen if we combined these things and applied the contemplative approach to observing the natural world and of telling stories about the natural world? So I set out near my house onto a wooded mountain slope in Tennessee and wandered around haphazardly until I found a rock that looked like I could sit on it with a reasonable degree of comfort for a year. And the area in front of that rock became my focal area for observation. The area was about 1 square meter, about the size of a small dining room table. And I returned to that over hundreds of hours through that year to just watch, be quiet, let go of the agenda of, you know, there's a lesson plan or a particular hypothesis that I'm testing, and just try and open my senses to the world and see what would happen. And then afterwards, I sort of ran off to the library and read all about the different things that I'd seen happening there. And often I knew a little bit, sort of the edge of many of those stories, and I'd taught about them and written some about them in scientific journals. But I wanted to go deeper into the scientific literature and really hold up that unseen world of wonder that science is uncovering.
Give me an understanding of the word mandala as you use it in this book.
Yeah. The guiding metaphor here is what I call the forest mandala. So the 1 square meter I call my mandala. And I took that metaphor from Tibetan Buddhism. And the mandala in Tibetan Buddhism is a circle of sand about the same size as my 1 square meter in the forest. But the circle of sand is created by monks, and it's an incredibly intricate sand painting, if you like, that is the creation of this mandala takes many days. It's an act of meditation. It's also an act of memory. So many of the details are added from memory. But ultimately, it's a representation of the entire universe. And in the Buddhist tradition, that would be the path to enlightenment. What I did was take that view, and I don't think any enlightenment was involved, but apply that same contemplative approach of narrowing down our gaze to a tiny little window and thereby hoping to perhaps see more than we could by running around the whole continent just trying to see it all and do it all. And that's the contemplative gambit. Narrow your gaze down to one breath, to one image, to one tiny little patch of forest. And then from that, perhaps you can, like a pinhole camera, you can see further into the universe, and the focus of the universe becomes crisper for you.
Were you taking notes at the time?
Much of the time I didn't. I sat and watched. But
just
I
sat?
Yeah, but I did have a notebook with me. My tools at the Mandala, I had a hand lens and some binoculars and a notepad and pencil. But mostly what I used the notepad to draw insects or flowers so I could identify them later and so forth. So I really didn't want the equipment, the writing equipment or cameras or microscopes and things to be getting in the way. I wanted this to be about the forest and my senses. And where could we go by stripping away some of the instrumentation? Not that microscopes or instruments aren't amazing things. They are. But for this particular project, I wanted to set them aside.
What example can you give me of one day's observation?
Excellent question. So it's a difficult question because, you know, each day is so, so very different. The thing that really struck me, if I'm thinking about a particular example, is in the late fall, sitting in the forest and finally becoming aware of how the light spectrum changes through the day and through the seasons. So, of course, as the tree canopy drops to the ground in the autumn, the intensity of light goes up, and we all know that, and that's fairly obvious. But what I had not realized until I'd sat there for many, many hours is how the texture of the light, which wavelengths are present, shifts through the day, but also through the year. And it turns out that the animals and plants in the forest mandala had learned this through natural selection many, many years before I became aware of it.
So. I'd like you to read for us from page 5, because I was utterly fascinated with this description.
I'd be happy to. So page 5, this is right at the beginning of the year. I've been sitting in the forest that is, although it's January 1st, we've had a little thaw, and I'm watching the lichens and the parasitic worms and so all sorts of creatures right there on the first day. Union, fusion. The mandala's inhabitants are plated into winning partnerships. But cooperation is not the only relationship in the forest. Piracy and exploitation are here also. A reminder of these more painful associations lies coiled on the leaf litter at the center of the mandala, enclosed by the lichen-coated rocks. The reminder unwrapped itself slowly, held back by the torpidity of my powers of observation. My attention was first drawn by two amber ants bustling across the wet leaf litter. I watched their scurrying for half an hour before I noticed the ants' particular interest in a coiled strand nestled in the litter. The strand was about as long as my hand and was the same rain-soaked brown as the hickory leaf on which it lay. At first, I dismissed the curl as an old vine tendril or leaf stem, but as my eyes were about to move on to more stimulating things, an ant paddled the tendril with her antennae, and the coil straightened and lurched. My mind startled into recognition. A horsehair worm, a strange creature with a taste for exploitation. The worm's twisting gave away its identity. Horsehair worms are pressurized from within, and the tug of muscles against this inflated body make the worm jerk and writhe like no other animal. The worm has no need of complicated or graceful movement, for at this stage of its life it has only two tasks left: to squirm toward a mate, and then to lay eggs. Nor did the worm have need of sophisticated motion in its previous life stage, where it lay balled inside the body of a cricket. The cricket did the worm's walking and feeding. The horsehair worm lived as an internal brigand, robbing, then killing the cricket. The worm's life cycle began when it hatched from an egg laid in a puddle or stream, The microscopic larva crawled over the stream bed until it was eaten by a snail or a small insect. Once inside its new home, the larva wrapped itself in a protective coat, formed a cyst, then waited. The lives of most larvae are cut short at this point as cysts, never completing the rest of the life cycle. The worm in the mandala was one of the few that made it to the next stage. Its host crawled onto land, died, and was chewed on by an omnivorous cricket. This is such an improbable sequence of events that the horsehair worm's life cycle requires parent worms to lay tens of millions of eggs. On average, only one or two of this multitude of young will survive to adulthood. Once inside the cricket, the spiny-headed larval pirate bored through the gut wall and took up residence in the hold, where it grew from a comma-sized larva to a worm the length of my hand, coiling upon itself to fit within the cricket. When the worm could grow no more, it released chemicals that took over the cricket's brain. The chemicals turned the water-fearing cricket into a suicidal diver, seeking puddles or streams. As soon as the cricket hit water, the horsehair worm tensed its strong muscles, ripping through the cricket's body wall and twisted free, leaving the plundered vessel to sink and die.
David George Haskell. The book is titled The Forest Unseen. Welcome back. David George Haskell is with me. He's professor of biology at the University of the South. He was named the Carnegie Case Professor of the Year in Tennessee in 2009. His new book, all about his experiences watching over a simple plot of ground within the forest for about a year, is the subject of his new book. It's titled The Forest Unseen. You can join us. We're going to open the phone shortly. 800-433-8850. Here's an email from Andrea, who says, I'm curious if and how your guest disguised or camouflaged himself during his observations to prevent his own presence from affecting the behavior of the plants, animals, and insects. What a good question.
That is a fabulous question. Thank you, Andrea. I did not dress myself in a lot of camouflaged gear. In fact, I don't own any pieces of camouflaged clothing in my wardrobe. However, I do make a habit of not wearing bright clothes out in the woods. And the main practice was to sit and to be still. That is the magic door into the forest, is stillness And people have known this for thousands, probably millions of years. Hunters and nature observers and bird watchers and photographers. Animals get alarmed by our noisiness, by our big size, by our motion. And so by being still, we can settle down and connect in a little bit to the way the forest is when we're not present. However, dissociated observation is not possible in the woods. And I think that's also sort of a deep philosophical statement, in that the physicists are also telling us that dissociated observation of the universe is not possible. We're all sort of all wrapped up in this together. The old notion of a purely objective observer doesn't hold any water anymore, I don't think. So certainly some animals would have been more hesitant to come to this square meter with my presence there. Others seem not to really bother them. I had a number of, bird would sat on my foot, a deer nearly trampled me over, the raccoons came by, and so really being still and just hunkering down in my little brown jacket seemed to settle things down quite a bit.
At one point, you decided that you would even take it a step farther and be unto nature as nature was unto you, and that was totally naked. Would you read for us that portion?
Absolutely. So here we're in January, and I wanted to...
in January.
So this is the coldest day in January, and so here we go. I'm taking my clothes off on the air. January 21st, the experiment. A polar wind rips across the mandala, streaming through my scarf, pushing an ache into my jaw. Not counting the wind chill, it is 20 degrees below freezing. In these southern forests, such cold is unusual. Typical southern winters cycle between thaws and mild freezes with deep chills, arriving for a few days each year. Today's cold will take the mandala's life to its physiological limits. I want to experience the cold as the forest's animals do, without the protection of clothes. On a whim, I throw my gloves and hat onto the frozen ground. The scarf follows. Quickly, I strip off my insulated overalls, shirt, t-shirt, and trousers. The first 2 seconds of the experiment are surprisingly refreshing, a pleasant coolness after the stuffy clothes. Then, the wind blasts away the illusion, and my head is fogged with pain. The heat streaming out of my body scorches my skin. A chorus of Carolina chickadees provides the accompaniment to this absurd striptease. The birds dance through the trees like sparks from a fire, careening through twigs. They rest no more than a second on any surface, then shoot away. The contrast on this cold day between the chickadees' liveliness and my physiological incompetence seems to defy nature's rules. Small animals should be less able to cope with the cold than their larger cousins. The volume of all objects, including animal bodies, increases by the cube of the object's length. The amount of heat that an animal can generate is proportional to the volume of its body. So heat generation also increases with the cube of body length. But the surface area where heat is lost increases by only the square of length. Small animals cool rapidly because they have proportionally much more body surface than body volume. The relationship between the size of animals and the rate of heat loss has produced geographic trends in body sizes. When an animal species exists over a large area, the individuals in the north are usually larger than those in the south. This is known as Bergman's rule, after the 19th century anatomist who first described the relationship. Carolina chickadees in Tennessee live toward the northern end of the species range, and they are 10 to 20% larger than individuals from the southern limit of the range in Florida. Tennessee birds have tipped the balance between surface area and body volume to match the colder winters here. Farther north, Carolina chickadees are replaced by a closely related species, the black-capped chickadee, which is 10% larger again. Bergman's rule seems remote, as I stand naked in the forest.
How long did you actually stand naked in the forest?
It took just a few minutes, and my body was shaking. And the thing that really drove me to put the clothes back on, other than a sense of embarrassment, was that there was something coming from my subconscious mind that was deeply alarmed. I was dropping into the edges of hypothermia, and
really?
My fingers weren't
very
working
quickly.
And so forth. And this is just 2 or 3 minutes, and yet these birds live here all winter. And Tennessee is pretty wussy when it comes to winter. I mean, we got similar birds up in Canada and some even in the Arctic in the middle of winter where the sun never rises. It's freezing cold. How do they do it?
Interesting. I have on one occasion visited the University of the South.
Fabulous.
So I know its beauty and I know its surroundings, but how far from the university was the forest in which you created your mandala?
So the university is a small liberal arts college and a small little town, and yet the university owns 13,000 acres of forest. And so I was actually on campus still. So from my office and my house, which is very close to my office, it was, 5 minutes on a bicycle, and then 15 minutes down the trail. So quite close into a small town and a small campus. And yet this mountain slope, as far as we know, at least portions of it have not been cut for timber. Now, other portions, there are homesteads and old whiskey, moonshine stills, and so on, a very rich cultural history as well, going back to the Native American culture that lived there, of course.
All right, let's open the phones. There are people who have their own comments for you. First to Fort Wayne, Indiana. Good morning, Chad. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Very good. No, I wanted to compliment this gentleman on his obvious passion that he has when he's talking about this. I was born and raised a farmer, and just to hear someone who not only takes what he sees and hears, but what he feels, that's something that's so important in agriculture. And just to hear someone echo that is just, it's very refreshing, and I really appreciate you doing this segment.
Well, thank you. And I think the agrarian tradition is one of the great places in which human culture and the community of life come together in ways that really sustain us. Of course, that's how human civilization is built on agriculture now. And for farmers who really take the time to observe,
of course,
the plants and animals that they live with, it's really enriching. My wife and I have a small little farm, and so I can appreciate that. We grow quite a bit of our own food.
Chad, thanks for calling. What did you learn about bees?
About bees, yes. Well, in the springtime, the forest explodes as the weather warms up and the leaves have not quite come out on the tree, in the tree canopy. All these little wildflowers that mostly are about ankle height come seemingly from nowhere, just exploding like a starburst of life coming from the soil. Within my 1 square meter, there were probably about 300 of these, and the whole mountainside was covered in a similar density. It wasn't that this particular square meter was particularly special in that regard. And there are little bees that come out that time their life cycle to coincide with this emergence of spring wildflowers, and to see that intensity of life after a fairly long winter all exploding out is quite remarkable. Some of these flowers, Spring Beauty is the name of one of the species of wildflowers, has pink pollen. And so you have little black bees going, flying around dusted with pink pollen. And what they're doing is they're gathering the pollen and the nectar to take back into little nests that they make inside hollow logs or inside the soil to raise their young. Unlike honeybees that make it through the winter as a big colony, these native bees generally overwinter as solitary future queens, if you like, that then start out the year on their own and have to raise their nest from the ground up, literally, through that 1 year. So the female bee makes a little nest, raises some young, and in many species, those young then become her helpers and her workers, and they produce more and more. And it's a very social system.
You say that some of these bees actually become competitive.
Can you repeat that question? Sorry.
The bees become competitive.
Oh, absolutely, yes. So within the hive, we think of this hive as this beautifully
organized,
controlled system, yeah. But really that there are a lot of conflicts happening within the hive. And particularly at the early stages, this is some jostling. You know, some of those worker bees would actually like to be reproductive bees. And so there's chemical suppression from the queen to some of her workers. And the workers have some conflicts of interest about are they going to raise more sisters or brothers and so on. So this notion of a perfectly smoothly running cooperative world inside animal societies is one that really doesn't hold up. And I think that applies with humans too, right? We're very social, and yet we have conflict.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's take another call in San Antonio, Texas. Hi there, Roger.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
It's a very interesting discussion.
Good.
It's one that it's close to my own experience. I remember when I was very young, I used to just sit and watch a small patch of ground. It wasn't even a square meter; might have been 6 inches square. And I would lay down and I'd look at the plants and the roots and the ants moving among the jungle of the clover stems or whatever it was, and the crystalline grains of sand. And I always thought if I could know everything there was to know about this one little patch of ground, I would know so much about everything else. And it's just interesting to hear someone with the same sort of sensibility, and I certainly appreciate the conversation. Thank you very much.
Oh, good, Roger. I'm glad. You know, it strikes me that children these days have so little time to do exactly as Roger has suggested, just lying there watching that little patch of ground there. If we could encourage young children to do exactly that, they'd probably learn a great deal.
I absolutely agree. And thank you, Roger, for your comment. That's the image of the jungle of little plants there was just a beautiful one. So, I absolutely agree. I think all the electronic distractions that we have these days can not just for children, but can draw all of us out of our senses, so we're more concerned about the apps on our cell phone than the apps that we came preloaded with for free in our own bodies. And those are our senses. Pay attention to our sense of smell. Pay attention to the community of life that's swirling around us in urban areas as well as in the country. One of the encouraging trends I see in education is more and more people seeing what a great opportunity there is to connect children and young adults to the natural world. And I think that conversation was not happening back perhaps many decades ago. And now there are lots of educational reformers, there are lots of people working in elementary schools and colleges trying to form that connection. And I think that's encouraging. Partly it's a symptom of the fact that we have become disconnected, but at least we're realizing this. We're waking up and re-establishing those bonds. And the great thing is, once you get a taste of it, you're hooked. You want to come back for more. And it's so life-enriching to be connected to the stories of other creatures. It's also humbling because it makes one realize, well, there's a lot more in this world than just humans or just my own story.
Did you ever feel concerned? You've said that you almost got run over by a deer. I mean, was there ever a moment during that year where you felt some concern for your own safety? Other than when you took off your clothes.
Yeah, that was a self-inflicted wound. There were moments, but not very many of them. And the moments, interestingly, came from my subconscious. So one of those, a significant one, I was sitting in the dark, and some coyotes started howling very, very close to me. And immediately, out of my unconscious comes this thought, you are about to get torn apart by wild dogs. Get out of here. And then a fraction of a second later, my conscious mind comes in, well, you know, that's not the case. You know, these are coyotes, and here in Tennessee, they're pretty heavily persecuted. They're frightened of you. And so there's nothing to be worried about. But that told me, well, my mind has some whispers coming from my ancestors here. There's some wisdom embedded in my nervous system that I need to listen to.
David Haskell, he is professor of biology at the University of the South. His new book is titled The Forest Unseen, A Year's Watch in Nature.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at troweprice.com. And by the Scan Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence at thescanfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Wine dates back 8,000 years, but ancient wine was quite different than the drink we know today. For one thing, it tasted pretty bad. So bad that people would add things like lead, pine resin, and marble dust to improve the taste. On the next Fresh Air, Paul Lucas talks about the history of wine. His new book is called Inventing Wine. Join us.
If you've just joined us, David Haskell is with me. He's professor of biology at the University of the South at Sewanee, and his new book is titled The Forest Unseen, A Year's Watch in Nature. Here's an email from Dan, who says, I'm puzzled and fascinated by the ability of insects to achieve leverage enabling movement and startlingly long jumps in some species with such thin leg diameters. My understanding of leverage potential is that it requires a certain component's thickness to gain force. Can you talk about that?
Excellent question. So that's a question about biomechanics. And the first thing I'd say is that insects are very light. And so we humans are very dense creatures. Whereas in an insect's body, there's actually a fair amount of air. They breathe through little passageways of air that penetrate their bodies. So volume for volume, they're actually lighter weight than many of them are lighter weight than humans are. The other thing that that many animals do, not just insects, but also frogs as they jump, is that they'll store up energy in their muscles and tendons like a spring. So it's like they're cranking this thing up and then releasing it all at once. So that's an Now, I'm not an expert on every insect's biomechanics by a very long shot, but that's my understanding of how they achieve some of these rather impressive feats, is through that storing of potential energy and then releasing it with muscles that are actually quite proportionally large in relation to the weight of their bodies.
And an email from Kim in Indiana. Who is your target audience for the book? And was part of your intent in writing the book to excite people about biology and the environment?
Excellent question. My target audience would be anyone who wants to dive a little deeper into the stories of the world we're in. So the book is about a square meter in Tennessee, but many of the creatures and the ecological and evolutionary processes that I talk about are universal. I know a number of children have been reading this, maybe 12-year-olds on up. I think the local high school where I live has been using it as a summer reading. So I think it's appropriate for young naturalists.
Absolutely.
The target audience was not those specialists in my field. I really wanted this to be for people who didn't have a PhD in some small little area of biology. No, let's take those amazing things from biology and tell those stories in a way that is accessible and compelling and honors the forest, but also honors the musicality of language, and try and tell this story in a compelling way.
You know, we've talked thus far about pretty much what you've seen. What about what you heard while you were in the forest?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I ask my students this question all the time. What have you heard? Sound is a great way of becoming aware of one's environment. So there's a lot more attention nowadays, not just to the particular individual sounds, but how they unite together into whole soundscapes. And by sitting quietly, what I found happened was I could sink into that soundscape, and the alarm calls and so forth of the animals that had seen me coming died down. So when something happened, like a crow flew over the forest or a deer startled when it came across me, I could hear how these waves of acoustic communication would travel out through the forest. And I realized that the animals are connected in an acoustic network, a news network. They know what is happening 100 meters down the mountain slope without seeing it because they're listening. So it's almost like they've got Wi-Fi in the woods, except it's a lot better than Wi-Fi because it connects them in multiple modalities, smell and sound. And I found I could tell when people were coming down the trail. There was a trail further down slope. I could tell when they were going to be arriving before I saw them, because all the chipmunks would start alarm calling. Like a bow wave of alarm, of acoustic alarm, would precede the arrival of the humans. So listening allowed me to tap in a little bit to that.
And what about your sense of smell?
Yeah, the sense of smell is that great connection to the subconscious, right? So a smell from childhood will snap on a memory and so forth. It's also our connection into the invisible world of the microbes, which is, if you like, the subconscious of the world. We can't see these microbes, and yet they are truly the 99% that run the ecology of the planet. If you get down near some soil or pick some soil up in your hand and smell it, if it smells healthy, that kind of rich, earthy smell, that's the smell of actinomycetes, which are little colonial bacteria that they do all sorts of things. Some of them are parasites or predators or decomposers. One useful thing that we have managed to learn from them is we've extracted antibiotics. So many of our more successful antibiotics have come from that soil microbial community that we can't see, but we can access it at least in part through our noses.
All right, let's go to Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, Susan.
Hi. It's interesting. I've lived in the city. I grew up in the city, and now I live in a rural area. And one of the things I've noticed when I'm out walking in the countryside is that my filters are all sort of reversed or really open to noticing all sorts of things, whereas when I'm in the city, you're filtering out all the assault of so much that you sort of pick and choose what, you know, what you're exposed to or what you really take in. But when you're out in the country, you're so much more aware because your filters are all off.
That's an excellent point. The different environments, particularly environments that we're used to, we tend to have a different sensory approach to them. But I would say even in the country, it's helpful to have a practice of reminding oneself to pay attention. So, okay, well, have I actually paid attention to any smells today? And I know I haven't. I need to do that when I have lunch today. But so in the city, we are indeed assaulted by many sounds that are not part of our evolutionary heritage, diesel trucks. The amplitude of sound in particular is much higher than is present in many different ecosystems. So it tends to cause us to shut off. But I would say the contemplative approach could also be applied in the city. And in fact, one of my favorite things to do is to sit on a busy sidewalk and just open myself to the soundscape and to stop judging it like, oh, that's a sound that's making me angry or tense. It's just, wow, listen to that diesel truck. Mm. That is the sound of 200 million-year-old sunlight that got buried and now is being released as we burn that oil. It's that sunlight is coming out in a great roar. In some ways, it's quite a beautiful thing. Now, sometimes we need to filter it off and pay attention to where we're walking so we don't walk into the lamppost.
But, of course, the other element that has come in to sort of get between us and sounds and smells and everything else is the cell phone. And I have seen, I walk my dog every day, and he's a little fellow. He does not like it if I have a cell phone in my hand. So I keep it in my pocket and pay full attention to him. And there is a difference in my relationship to him because of that, and my relationship to my surroundings.
Absolutely. I think your dog has a very good detector of when your attention is devoted to him or her, and then when your attention is it's directed elsewhere. And I think that the ubiquity of cell phones is, in some ways, is a reflection of the fact that our society has been exploded apart, right? So even the people we're closest to, we spend most of the day away from them, and our friends and family are all over the place. And here's this technology that can reconnect us. So in some way, we're going back to the Pleistocene campfire of our friends and kin with these cell phones, reconnecting with our close social group. So when I see that blue glow coming on people's faces as they gaze at their cell phone, I'm seeing the glow of a campfire. So from way back, and that's why they're so addictive to us, is because we're highly social creatures.
Interesting. All right, to Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi there, Jonathan.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for having me on.
Surely. Good.
Never imagined I'd be calling in for this show, but I had to when I listened to the premise of this professor's book, because I went through a period where I sat quietly for years and reflected. And it was in the same place he was. It was at the University of the South. But instead of looking at something narrow and minor, I sat at the cross, Professor, and I looked out over the landscape. Suwannee, the University of the South, is on the finger of a plateau and has several overlooks where you can see dozens and dozens of acres, hundreds of acres. And I watched as the sun set every night for a period of about 5 years, five happiest years of my life at Suwannee. But I'd love to hear your reaction to taking a macro approach to what you did in a micro approach and the ways that they can be similar.
That's fabulous. Thank you, Jonathan. It's great to hear from you. And for listeners who are not familiar with the geography of Suwannee, the cross is a big war memorial cross that overlooks most of the county there. There's this beautiful view, and when the sun sets, it's just fabulous. I would say that what you did was in some ways macro, sort of looking out, but in other ways it really was the same thing. It was returning over and over again to the same place to see how the texture and feel of that place changed day by day. And so whether we're gazing at little snails in front of us or gazing at the beauty of a sunset, the practice is returning, often when it's inconvenient to us, right? But having that discipline, saying, I'm going to come back and be faithful to this place every day or every week or whatever the practice is, and see how that changes me and see how the place can open me up. So I'm delighted to hear that happened also in Suwannee. I know that there are several students who've done this from other overlooks who've had a practice of going out every day as the sun sets just to check in with themselves from the craziness of sort of campus life and sort of that period going from 18 to 21 years old. There's a lot of things swimming in your mind and emotions. And it's a touchstone for them. And that gives me great pleasure to know and great hope as well that there are folks who are swimming down just to check in with the world and themselves on a regular basis.
I wonder about the new study on carbon emissions that came out this week saying that global carbon dioxide emissions have increased by 58% since 1990. They rose 3% in 2011, 2.6% in 2012. You were there for 1 year. I wonder how what you saw might have been affected by these carbon emissions.
That's a great question, and the rising levels of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases like methane is the big question of our times, and it will be the question for the next generations to come. And there's a lot that could be said about that. One thing I would say in general is that forests and the oceans have sucked up a lot of the carbon dioxide that we've released. And so this study for me underscores the importance of protection and good management of forests, because half of the carbon that we've burned from fossil fuels has been drawn in by forests and by the oceans. So we'd already be much further along the climate change trajectory if it wasn't for those forests. I would also say that any kind of natural observation of nature these days is tinged with a sense of impermanence, and that the Tibetan mandala is impermanent as well. When it's finished, it's swept up and thrown into flowing waters. But ecosystems are going to be radically different in 100 years because of climate change. So what I saw is just a snapshot.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. A last question from Steve in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning to you, Steve.
Morning, Diane. It's a pleasure to talk to you. And
thank
I want to first
you.
Say that your interview with F. Murray Abraham was maybe the best I've ever heard.
Oh, that's great. Thank you. It was a delight to talk with him.
And David, fascinating. I'm looking forward to ordering the book off Amazon. You're like a modern-day Thoreau.
Thank you.
One question. In the year you were there, did you use any of your students to help you with the research and to tabulate the data? And have you used any of this in your classroom?
I did not use the students at this one square meter. I take my students out in the woods all the time. In fact, I'm running back to Suwannee tonight so I can be on time for class tomorrow. I do a lot of work with my students. This particular in the woods, this particular project, I wanted to just be stripped down to me, the woods, my senses. What can I make from this? And so, in terms of how this impacts the classes, though, I would say I do more of this contemplative approach to observing nature than I used to. So I will ask students through a semester, in addition to all the experiments and the statistics and the other things that we're doing as sort of as scientists, to choose a little patch of ground and watch it for a semester, or to choose a soundscape on a particular part of campus and listen to it through many months. To me, these things are not in conflict. Science and contemplative practice can support and inform one another and give us a more complete view of what our relation to the world is and what our understanding of the world is, and I'm bringing more of that into my classes.
How do you think you've been changed by the year you spent?
I would say that I'm a lot more aware of how often my senses are actually closed down and that I need to wake up and start listening. The other thing I got was a real deep sense in my bones that we are kin to the rest of the community of life. When I look at a tree, it's my cousin. And that's the great Darwinian insight that I don't think is fully filtered into our cultural consciousness yet, is that we truly belong in this world.
David George Haskell. His new book is titled The Forest Unseen, A Year's Watch in Nature. You inspire me.
Thank you, Diane. It's been a great pleasure and honor to be here.
Thank you. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Susan Neighbors, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, and Jill Colgan. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Natalie Urov-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. And we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.